My name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic. I like to take my hat off. I'm practicing hardening my head off, but if the AC gets too cold, I'm going to put it back on. So I'm reading a book right now from a friend of a friend, and the title is, How Come Every Time I Get Stabbed in the Back, My Fingerprints Are on the Knife? And I thought, well, damn, that sounds a lot like what I've been learning from doing step work in AA. And so what I'm going to start out with is, how did my fingerprints get on the knife? And that goes back to early causes and conditions. And the earliest cause was I was born, okay? And so were you. We came screaming into this world. Some guy grabbed us by the feet and smacked our behinds. Most of us couldn't talk for a whole year after that. Like many of you, I was born into an alcoholic family, and that means there was a lot of screaming and hitting and strange behavior that I just thought was normal. And it's my personal opinion that those first few years of life, there's a couple kids in here who aren't 3 years old yet. We're really not conscious. Yay, there he is. We're really not conscious of what's going on, and yet somehow we're registering it all. And I was making decisions about what was going on. And that got planted in my reptile brain. That's that glob of brain right on top of the spine. It does some good things. It's the reason my heart beats without my thinking about it. It's the reason that I breathe without thinking about it. But it's also the reason why I have these strange instincts to come flying out of nowhere and start making up stories about what's going on. Okay. Part of being raised in an alcoholic family meant that I learned fear early on. I learned a lot of fear responses. I also learned how to be very tough, a badass. There are a lot of badasses in this room. I can see you now. We recognize each other, right? Yeah, there she is. There you are. There you are. Yeah. And what I think about myself is that all of this sets something up that made it really difficult to cope with life. And it was just hard until I was about 5 years old. And we had the big family gatherings at our house, and everybody drank. And they thought it was so cute that the little kids would go out to the kitchen and make highballs for everybody. And, of course, my sisters and my cousins and I were all sampling as we made these highballs. And I didn't know that's what getting drunk felt like, but that was my first little taste of it. But I didn't really get in trouble. Well, I had a little bit of trouble when I was 12. I was honored to be the altar boy at midnight mass, but because everybody was at my house, and that's when you uncork the couple of barrels of wine that are down in the basement that the uncles and my dad made and see how it came out, well, I drank a little bit of too much, and I got too drunk and couldn't make it to midnight mass. So that's where it all started. There's something else that started around that age. And I've talked to a lot of people in AA who at 12, 13 years old start taking a look around at the people in their church and their religion they're in and wondering what the heck is going on, because we start to see the difference between how they're talking and how they're behaving. And at that point, I decided this God stuff was nonsense. I confused religion with God, and I just let go of any notion of God whatsoever. And I seemed to do okay. The next time I got in trouble, it was homemade wine again. I was in college. I was on a football scholarship, doing quite well. My roommate was there on a basketball scholarship, really tall guy. We used to call him the preacher. He had a Bible that was outlined in 7 different colors, and he spent a lot of time on his knees praying. He was a very devout young man. And when I came home from Christmas break with a bottle of homemade wine, he was very upset, because back in those days, you were not allowed to have alcohol on campus. And so he turned me into the dean. And that was the beginning of my saying, the hell's this? Another thing happened back at this time when I was in college, the Vietnam War was going on. And some protesters came around protesting the Vietnam War, and I didn't like them. I thought they were snooty New Englanders. And I was raised up to be a red, white, and blue boy. My daddy worked in the mill. All my uncles worked in the mill. We were working class. And they were all war heroes. They had pictures. Grandma had pictures on the wall of all the uncles in their military uniforms. And they had been through battles. And according to them, they were all heroes and had stories to tell about it. And so my sense of patriotism was affronted by this. And then the third thing happened. I put $250 down on a motorcycle at a Honda shop. And when I finally got the scratch to get the whole bike, I went down there and said, "We can't sell it to you." They said, "You're not 21 yet. Your mother was down here." It's like, she said, if we sell you that bike, she's going to sue us, so we can't sell you that bike. And that was it, man. I was just steamed. And I thought, how can I get back at my mother? You know, I can't holler at her because she can out-holler me. So I decided, I know I'm going to drop out of college and enlist in the military. And I did. I went down to the Marine Corps recruiting office, and they were closed. And I went next door to the Navy recruiters, and they were open. The guy says, "What do you want to be?" And I said, "I want to be a frogman." And he said, "Do you like hospital work? Do you like medical work?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Sign here, sign here, sign here." And I was shipped off to hospital corps school. Okay, right? I learned right then, read it before you sign it. So anyhow, I'm in the Navy, a hospital corpsman. That's a kind of a medic that's attached to the Marines. Am I that bad, honey? The only story I'll tell you about that is they took me out of the field and put me into what they call a sick bay, a dispensary, and they put me in the laboratory. And my job was to take specimens and look at them under a microscope. Now, on any given sick day, you got 70 Marines and soldiers in line, and every single one of them has the clap. That's what happens, yeah. And so all day long, I would take a little sample. I saw more dicks than anybody in here. Well, anyway, what a story there is. The story there is my footrest at the microscope was 2 5-gallon cans of grain alcohol. They had it there to make up compounds. And there was a plastic seal on it, so you couldn't pour anything out of it. But Wilcox showed me how to take a spinal needle and a 60cc syringe and plunge it through the seal and draw some of that up. And I would do that all day with my coffee, with apple juice, with grapefruit juice, sometimes just with water. And I stayed so drunk. And they caught on, the chief caught on. So they said, "We can't have this." And they reassigned me to the pharmacy. I guess I should say something about military intelligence right there. So that's where I discovered prescription drugs. And my favorite, of course, was dexedrines. We had those because in the Navy you put some in the lifeboat, you carry some in your pack. We also carried morphine, and I tried some of that. And I wasn't down with the downs, but I was up with the ups. And so anyhow, that's where I really got into drinking heavily and really got into drugs and came back. And some of you have heard the stories. I landed in San Francisco, and it wasn't a hero's welcome. People were spitting on us and calling us baby killers. And I had that experience of being socially ostracized, especially by my age group. And when you're 20 years old, you know what you want to do. And so that wasn't open to me because I was from the military. So I immediately kind of changed my colors. I went over there red, white, and blue and came back red. I was very angry. I couldn't stand the way I felt. I stayed drunk for a very long time. During my 20s, I had a ball. I was all over the United States. I left with rock and roll. And when I was in Vietnam, I discovered country music. I'd never heard it before. But I came home to Janis Joplin and the Doors and Jimi Hendrix, and that whole thing was on. It was 1969, 1970, and that's when the 60s really happened. I mean, it was going on all over the country. And I got real swept up in that. But I was like, I don't know. I like to think I was like a Ronin, a wandering warrior. But the fact is, I was a freak and homeless and just hitchhiking all around the place and sleeping on people's couches and just staying really drunk. And it was a ball until I hit my 30s. And then it wasn't fun anymore. By that time, I had a girlfriend. I had a wife. Oh, yeah, that's right. I did have a wife. And, oh, yeah, we had a baby. Yeah. That was right after Vietnam. It was a pretty girl who was smiling at me, just like you are now. And she got pregnant, and I said, let's get married and have a baby. The Navy pays for all that, and we did, and they did. And she asked me for a divorce, and I was standing like this. Because I was in a jail cell, solitary confinement. I had been busted in Mississippi for possession of marijuana, which is very bad. Guy next to me was a murderer. The guy on the other side was a rapist who raped 70-year-old women. That was his thing. But I was the evil one at that time. In those days, it was probably the worst thing you can do, according to some people. Anyhow, we got divorced, she immediately remarried, and somebody else raised my son. It's an alcoholic story that many of us men know about, okay? And many of us women probably know about that, too. Anyhow, I met Elaine, and she had a little girl, and I helped raise that little girl. And we were the hot couple. You know, we had champagne in the freezer, 10 keys up in the attic. There was always a bunch of people in the kitchen, kids and dogs, and it was going on. And it went downhill till it just got really bad. I can't remember half of it. I do remember at one point she was saying, they don't want you to come to the party. You know, because I was kind of in the habit of wrecking furniture and things like that. And then one other thing I remember her saying to me is, you're narcoleptic. You know, you're like catatonic. And I was. I couldn't answer her. I was smoking hash and drinking so much that I was just out of it all the time. And we parted ways, and she died soon afterwards. And I went bumping along the bottom for a few years from one place to another. I did a series of geographics. The story there is you go someplace else, nobody knows you. Us alcoholics are so charming. You get along really well for a month or two, and then they discover, oh, my God. Yeah. And you go to the next place and do it all over again. And in one of these places, San Francisco, I had a pretty cool job. I was teaching in a jail. I worked for a clinic. And my coworker pulled me aside and said, Damon, I have to ask you something. And she was a beautiful woman. I said, sure. And she said, I want to tell the boss I'm going to be late coming back from lunch because I'm going to an AA meeting over the lunch hour. And I said, oh, that'll be fine. He'll be okay with that. I had no idea what she was doing. You know, today we call it 12-stepping. She was 12-stepping me. She was letting me know. And she finished it with, if you ever want to go to a meeting with me, here's my number. Oh, I got her telephone number. Oh. So it was about a year later. I mean, I felt like, you know, after the rainstorm, you see a worm on a sidewalk. It's all pale and half dead. That's how I felt all the time. The juice was gone. You know, my life was empty. You know, just going to the bar every night and drinking, you know. So I went to this meeting, and it was at that time, it was the seedy part of town. Thanks to Google Kids, now it's a very trendy part of town. But, I mean, there are some down-and-out characters in there. And she said, when they call for newcomers, if you want, you can put your hand up and say I'm an alcoholic. And I did. My name is Damon. I'm an alcoholic. And at that moment, my world shifted. I could literally feel my world shifting. And I hung out and listened to them talk, and I was amazed. It's like, you're my people. You've been through what I've been through, almost everything that everybody said. The guy who wrote this book about my fingerprints on the knife, he studied successful managers, and he said what they do is they look at a lot of information, a lot of data, but they don't work with that data. They just set it aside. They put it on a back burner and let it cook. And that started happening to me in meetings. I would hear anywhere from 5 to 12 people talk in a meeting on every given night. And they all had a little something to say that was like, wow, yeah, I get that. And after thousands of pieces of information came, I started seeing pictures emerging about what was going on inside of me, inside of my heart, inside of my mind, inside of my body. And it's like, damn, I am an alcoholic. I was relieved to find it's a disease. I didn't have to be ashamed. Cancer is a disease. We don't make fun of people with cancer. It's not because I had no willpower, which is what dozens of people told me. You have no willpower. You should just slow down your drinking. My mother said when she found out I was an AA, you're not going to quit drinking altogether, are you? She's a good codependent wife, you know. So I started going to meetings and getting sober. And I went through the steps very slowly because I'm a knucklehead. I'm hard-headed. I got this. I know it's right. And so I couldn't quite get them. First two steps I got, I knew I couldn't quit drinking. There was times I got this one job where I was going to be a teacher, and they said, you have to have a physical. There's no hurry. 6 months into the job, they said, you know, we don't have your physical yet. And I realized the reason I didn't is because I didn't want to go to the doctors when I was hungover or drunk. And I was hungover or drunk all the time. This was amazing, you know? Huh. And when I finally did go, I forgot. And he was palpitating my liver and said, do you drink much? And I said, oh, I might have one or two a day. And he had that look. But all he said was, well, you know, one or two a day might be too many. And, you know, what I know now that I did not know then is my liver was swollen, okay? I was drinking so much, my liver was swollen. I also found out in sobriety that I had hep C, as did, God, it seems like 80% of my generation got hep C because we all shared needles, you know. We all did all kinds of stuff together, and it's an epidemic. And I hope that you've had a chance to get checked for it, too, if you've shared needles or done other things that mix fluids that can carry hep C. There's no shame in having hep C. The treatment for it now is real easy. When I went through it, it was sheer hell. You had to shoot yourself up in the stomach every day and take some kind of little pill that lowered your red blood count, and I felt like shit. And halfway through it, you go crazy. You get insane. I'd never felt that kind of insane before. And I was living with a wonderful woman who had more time than I did in the program, and she was going through menopause. Yeah, that was a fun household, man. But you know what? We made it through that. We made it through that. By working the steps of the program. It's pretty damned amazing. Anyhow, I started in on how working the steps was slow. The first one that I had trouble with was the third step, this God thing. I had confused religion with God, and I wasn't going to do that. What the hell is this God thing? And I started going to atheist and agnostic meetings, and there weren't many women there. They were all philosophers. The kind of philosophers you meet on bar stools who, you know, who spin up absolute truth out of thin air, and it's just a bunch of bullshit. And being sober, I could see that. It's like, oh, my God. And then one day, one of them popped a beer can in a meeting, you know, and started drinking. And it was like, oh, okay. And then some magic happened. My sponsor, who is a guy younger than me, and he latched on to me because he wanted a motorcycle like mine, and we found him one. And he said, you know, get on your knees every morning and say this prayer, the third step prayer. And I couldn't remember. It had these and thous in it. And it was like, oh, God, I wrote it down on a piece of paper, got on my knees every day for a year and had to read the piece of paper. But something happened in that year. Something else shifted in me. And I'd like to say it was a spiritual experience, but in fact it was like a bulldozer finally scraped that big pile of bullshit out of the way that I had made up with my mind about what was real, okay? And I got it. And I remember that night holding hands in a circle and saying the Lord's Prayer and crying because I was coming back home to something I had known as a child, something that was real, something that was touching, something that really resonated with me. And that woke me up. I took another year to do my fourth step. I approached it a little differently. Yeah, I did the grid, but I saw that I was just going to shine that on and run right through, and it wasn't going to settle inside of my bullshit mind. And so I started writing. Like anything that happened, I wrote the story out. I wrote out what happened, what I felt like, what the other person did. Because, you know, until I really got it, none of this was my fault, you know? This couldn't be my fingerprints on the knife. I was wearing gloves. And the joke at that time was, my God, I got to write this four step. I only have a 20 megabyte hard drive. I'm running out of space. Yeah. And that's what I had to do. And as I started getting these vast stories, I started seeing common threads, and it all started to mush down into a few lines of common stories, which, lo and behold, turned out to be the stuff that was in my columns. It's like, holy cow, these guys got this figured out. But I was too smart to know that, so I had to take the long route around. And, you know, you might have to do that too. And I got what was going on. And I started to see what my part in it was. I started to see how I stepped on the toes of my fellows and they retaliated. Man, that was news. There used to be a guy, may God rest his soul, named Buddy at the Western Trails who would say, I mailed myself a turd a couple weeks ago. And I was surprised when it showed up in my mailbox. You know, it's like, yeah, I had started all of this stuff that came around on me, and then I blamed the other people for it. I conveniently forgot what I had started. I started to see how I did that in romantic relationships, because I was younger, and romantic relationships were really important to me. And I can see how I would actively work to change that poor woman to become my mother, to become every other woman I had dated. What I was doing, the buttons I was pushing, what I was setting up to make her treat me in a way that I could say, oh, she's a bitch, she doesn't understand me, you know. My outlook on psychology is basically Freudian. I think all of us guys are looking for mama, and I think all of us girls are looking for daddy. There's something that happened early in life. Mama loved me, and she held me to her bosom, and it's like, that's all I want, is to be loved and held to your bosom. Of course, I wasn't breastfed. I was bottle-fed, so I just substituted it with a bottle, you know. But all of the little quirky things I had with my mother, I started to get a sense that, wow, I'm setting that up with her. And so at some point in my fourth step, I started getting to the bottom of things. And it started, in their wisdom, the guys who wrote the big book looked at our behavior, not our motivations, not what I was thinking, what I did, what happened with other people. And those things provided evidence about how I habitually reacted. And the one thing that stuck with me from the Big Book, it doesn't say defects of character. It says good instincts gone awry. Okay? It says an inventory of my character maladjustments. And I was definitely maladjusted. And these things were all instincts that went awry. And I'm convinced of that because today I've got 28 years sober, and the same damn shit keeps coming up over and over again. It's just that now when it comes up, I don't have to knee-jerk react to it. I could pause a second and say, oh, it's just that. Get back down there. No, don't come up here. And it's hard to get there. It's hard. It was very hard to do my fourth step because I'd spent a lifetime developing defenses to protect myself against the truth. You know, there's that Greek myth of Pandora's box. Don't open the box. And when she does, there's a bunch of demons in it. The fourth step is Pandora's box. There are all these demons in there, all of that stuff that I have hidden from myself and I thought from others, but, you know, we don't hide stuff from others. For years, I built elaborate defenses. It was like a Gothic castle, you know, with thick stones and high walls, and you couldn't get past it, although some people just marched right in. And one day I was sitting by a river, and there was an island in the river, and I saw all this. It was like a vision. I saw the castle of my defenses. And I happened to have a notebook with me, and I started writing it out. It's very important for me to write things down because I can have a silver tongue, and I can be really slick when I talk. And I'll forget tomorrow. I won't remember what I said today. But when I write it down, it's there, and I can go back to it. That's the value of journaling. And I wrote this down, and I went back and looked at it later and said, yeah, that's the way it worked. And I remembered in college I had heard of a book by Anna Freud called Defense Mechanisms. She was Sigmund Freud's, I don't know, daughter, niece, something like that. And in 1971, she wrote this book. Before that, a guy had written a book called The Games That People Play. You know, it's the bullshit things we do when we interact to try to reinforce our ego, to try to reinforce our story. I did all these things to make my story about what life was true. That way I could be Damon Almighty, king of the whole universe, you know. But it didn't work. And I kind of overstate this. This is something that we all do. You know, I'm inside my own head. My eyes are here. I could see that, and I can hear what's in my head, and I have a story about what life is. And I get some reinforcement from it, from movies and films and talking to other people. You know, we reinforce each other's stories. But a lot of the stories just simply don't work, especially if I'm the one who's running the show. When I first read I am the actor and the director, you know, I got that. It's like, holy shit, that's me. I'm writing my own plays. How many of us are going to have a fight with somebody? It's like, no, I'm going to say this, and she's going to say that. Then I'm going to say this, and she's going to say that. Now I'm going to say, and then we go and get the script out, and they don't follow the script. They have something. It's like, oh, shit, I didn't think she was going to say that. You know, there's a lot of conflict in the world, and I generated a lot of that conflict. Those are some of my fingerprints on that knife because I was trying to run my story, and I came into direct conflict with you and what you were doing, and so we fought, so we're in conflict. And we didn't always fight because we thought we wanted each other. We thought we wanted to be friends. We thought we were nice guys. So we didn't fight outright, but we had these sneaky little tricks that we did on each other, you know. And that's the way I lived my life, and I was unconscious of it. I didn't want to be conscious of it. The thing I love about this program is the thing I hated about it, and it is I know without a doubt I am responsible for all of my reactions to what happens to me in the world. I'm the author of that reality, you know. I'm not responsible that you did what you did, but I'm certainly responsible for my reaction to it. My anger, my gut reactions that make me steaming mad is due to the way that I programmed my reptile brain when I was a little baby like that one back there, you know. And that gives me power. I actually have power over my own destiny if I understand how I set myself up to operate in this world. You know, and we can't be human without setting ourselves up that way. But my God, to get an idea of it through working the fourth step and taking an inventory, that is magnificent. That is so powerful. And that is so frightening when we first start doing it. Anybody in here with a little bit of time can tell you, before they did their fourth step, they were paralyzed with fear. And by the time they were done, they were just jubilant. Oh, my God, why did it take me so long to do this? Okay. Fifth step is the same way. Holy cow, I've got to share this with another person. I hadn't shared that stuff with anybody except the really cool stuff that I might have shared with my buddies to make them think I was a badass like they were, or with my girlfriends to make them think that I was, you know, the most interesting man in the world. But by and large, no. And when I shared it, when I walked out of this guy's house in Petrero Hill in San Francisco, I was 90 pounds lighter. I was floating. I felt really good. Not everybody feels that way. Some people don't feel good after their fifth step. I did. Most people I know feel really good after they share it. It's the first true unburdening. It's the first thing that we do in this program with another human being. Up until then, it's all me doing it. You know, I'm admitting I'm powerless. I come to believe that I can change. I get on my knees and make a decision to turn my will over to a power greater than myself. I take my inventory. Now in the fifth step, I'm working with you or with her or with him. And so I'm starting to move this stuff out of me and into the world. And that continued as I work the steps. The big book gives step six and step seven. One of them is, I'm going to paraphrase, I decided I want to have my defects removed, and then I humbly asked God to remove my defects of character. And, you know, the big book doesn't say a lot about that, and I didn't do a lot about it except go through some motions. And years later, when this stuff was still pounding me, I realized, wow, I didn't spend enough time getting ready to have my defects removed. And for me, that meant I didn't really truly cop to some of them. I didn't see where they're coming from deep within me and how they were spiraling through my system and taking shape. And so I was hounded by the same shit over and over again. I did not become humble enough to feel that a power greater than myself could remove these things, because I went to college. You know, I know shit. I'm smart. I can figure this out. You know, I can rebuild a carburetor. But I couldn't rebuild my own psyche. I couldn't rebuild my life. I had to turn it over to a power greater than myself. And when I got that, my ninth step really started working well. And the first people I did nine step with was family. That was important to me. I'm really glad, because my dad died soon after it. Elaine, the woman I had lived with the champagne in the freezer, died soon after that. I was able to make my peace with them. My mother, a little more difficult. We actually had to meet in Las Vegas on neutral ground and have this long talk about what she did to me and what I did to her and how I saw it and how she saw it. And it was like, I don't know if you ever read a story where two different people tell the story and it's a different story. And I got it. It's like, I got that my perception is what creates my world, and her perception is what creates her world. You know, what is a real event? What actually did happen? I have only my recollection. I have only my story about it. And what if I'm not right? You know, what if it was a little bit different from the way that I see it? How would it look then? How would my reactions to it look? Well, they look kind of stupid. They look like I was a drunk, which I was. And I had to learn to forgive myself for that. That's very difficult. This guy named J.D. Hirsch, I think is his name, he wrote a book called Scales of Consciousness, trying to measure how conscious we are on some kind of a vertical scale. And he did this because materialists are in charge of the brain world. Nobody's talking about mind from a spiritual approach. because there's no facts and figures, and he tried to write these scales to give it some kind of quantifiable data. The important thing is, he said, guilt and shame are how the ego attempts to regain its power. Yeah, when I first heard that, it was just like, what the fuck's he talking about? And then I got it. It is. Oh, I'm so sorry. That means I'm trying to control you. My ego is going to gain control. Oh, I'm so ashamed. Maybe the cops will let me out of the back of the car if I say that. Maybe the judge will go easy on me. You know, maybe my girlfriend will come back. It's all like the ego trying to reclaim itself. It's not necessary to feel guilt and shame. It's something I learned because it got me out of court, it got me out of scrapes, first with my mom and dad, and then with girlfriends, and then with the judge. You know, they like to see that kind of behavior. But in fact, I don't have to feel guilt and shame. But I do have to say, yes, I was there, and yes, I did this thing. I treated you this way. And no, you didn't deserve it. And I was drunk and drinking, and I was making decisions based on my will, and you deserve better than that. And the results of that kind of amends with people, with old friends, was amazing. So many of them were just really happy. It's like, you've come back. I'm so happy you quit drinking. Thank you. This means the world to me. And there were a handful that said, fuck you, asshole. Get out of here. You know? And that happens too. Yeah. And with my family, it took a very long time for them to get it because they'd heard it all before. But they saw over a period of years that I had become a different person, that I had become a man instead of a whacked out boy. And they saw that. And my relationship with my family is really different now than it was during my drinking years. I'm really grateful for that because the family is who's closest to us, you know. And, man, I used to get pissed off. I would go home the first 5 years I was sober. I'd go home for a Christmas or a wedding or a funeral and expect everybody to say, oh, Damon's sober. How wonderful this is. And they didn't. They still treated me like the asshole that I had been, you know. But that's changed. And there are people in my old church community who just hated me because I quit drinking. Because,
Damon,
yes?
I'm so sorry, Roger. I want to tell you, you inspired me so much. I see so much myself in my brother.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, man. Thank you, brother. Okay. I thought I had gone over time or something.
It's true, me too.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Or maybe I was on a taboo subject because I was just going to talk. I was going to talk about going to a Serbian picnic and they come around with a platter of whiskey, and if you don't drink that whiskey, whoa, you're insulting the whole thing. And I didn't drink that whiskey, so I was on the outs with a lot of people in my original community. You know, by and by, they learned that I was a different kind of a man. And there are men in my church who are, they call them churchmen. They're guys who don't drink, they don't fuck around, they do a lot of service, and so they couldn't believe that I had become one of those people. It took them, some of them still don't get it, you know, it's like 2 or 3 decades later. They still, if they don't, that's the way it is. It's none of my business. Learn that in Al-Anon. What you think about me is none of my business, you know. If you hate me, none of my business. If you love me, it's none of my business. Yeah. Although I do appreciate it. I think I was talking about step 9, what happened with amends. And like a lot of people, I hadn't really worked 6 and 7 well enough, and I charged into my amends like a bull into a china shop, and I created a little bit of wreckage there. And my particular version of it was, I'm really sorry what I did to you. But if you weren't such a fucking asshole, I probably wouldn't have done it. not the way to do it. Okay. I'll just kind of work my way through the steps to tell you what happened. I got into the 10th step, and one of my early encounters with Chris was we were talking about the 10th step at a meeting, and I happened to mention the nightly inventory, how I take review of the day and what I did. And Chris thought, well, that's not the 10th step. The 10th step can happen anytime. It could happen right now, in the morning, in the evening, in the middle of the night, anytime. And it's true. Whenever I recognize, wow, I've tripped out. I got into a retrogressive groove and started acting defensive with you. It's like, whoa, whoa, stop. I'm sorry. I just got angry and fucked up, and I you didn't deserve that. I wasn't reacting to you. I was reacting to some brain fart that I had in my own head. We can do that anytime. The value of the 10th step is that it reinforces what I've learned from doing the 4th step. It reinforces what I've learned from doing the 9th step with people. And that needs to be reinforced every day. Why? Because I put those fingerprints on my knife handle a long time ago. I programmed my reptile brain. It's never going to change. I still have those same instincts. Okay? And if some little trigger happens, and God knows what the trigger might be, and I'll start reacting to it. If I recognize that, I can just pause. It's called pause when agitated. If I don't recognize it, I'm going to launch into something, right? I'm going to go off on you. And if I go off on you, I can make a correction. And every time that something comes up and I catch it and take a little chip off of it, it goes back down a little weaker than it was before. And eventually, a lot of those behaviors just disappear altogether. Some of them never will. And that's the way it is. I know a lot of us are plagued because, oh, I did my 4th step and this stuff keeps happening. Yeah, and it will. That's why they say we have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I have got to get on my knees every morning and pray. For me, if I go for a few days without meditating, I start getting like tense, a little angry, pissed off. God knows there's a lot to be pissed off in the world right now. The crazy shit that's going on. And it just starts getting to me until I find myself in traffic, snarling at people. You fucking asshole. It's like, what's going on, man? What is going on? Ah, I haven't meditated for a few days. When I meditate, I'm putting some space between my reptile brain and my emotional brain. See, the way that brain is set up is the signal come out of the reptile brain into the mammal brain. That's my emotional brain. So, zing, the first thing I have is a feeling. And a feeling can be like, or it can be like, okay? And I like the uhs better than the uhs, but it can go either way. And sometimes that can get me into more trouble than the right? So, the meditation puts a space there. So I'm able to pause when agitated. And usually when I pause, my mama taught me to count to 10. That's pretty high. When a bunch of... That's a long time. When a bunch of Tibetan monks got together with some neurologists in Boulder, Colorado in 1974, the monk said, well, what's one thing that you would like to be able to do? And the neurologist said, we would like people to pause for 4 seconds before they react to a stimulus. A stimulus is like whatever happened and I react to it. And that, they were saying we want people to be able to pause when they're agitated. And out of that meeting came the Naropa Institute and the Shambhala Buddhist movement that some of you know about here in Austin. And Pema Chodron and people like that who we listen to, a lot of people who are outside of the program and yet saying the very types of things that we're trying to get in here. There's a lot has happened since then that is bringing us towards peace, that is bringing us back to our hearts, that is causing us to change our sword and shields from defenders and killing weapons into something that's shielding bullshit and reaching for the truth. And that comes, that's 11th step stuff. That's prayer and meditation. The way I got prayer, it was from a novel by a really cute gal named Mary Carr, who looks good in a little square dancing dress. And in the middle of the novel, her sponsor tells her, you got to get on your knees and pray to God. And she says, pray to God? You mean that big babysitter in the sky? Or is this some kind of self-hypnosis? And it, for me, it's self-hypnosis. When I pray, I go to my very center in a quiet way without outside disturbances. And I touch something that brings out my higher self. And I vibrate at a higher level. And it makes my day go smoother and easily. And I can tell when other people are doing that. You know what it is when you encounter another soul who's vibrating at a high level. It feels good. And we all have that capability. And we can all be doing that. Okay. There are things like the Celestine Prophecy that says when we all get there, there will be no more wars. There will be peace on earth. We will return to the Garden of Eden. Okay. That's the direction we're moving in. Somewhere along the line of sobriety, I used to go to meetings with the bros and the hoes back when I was a bro. And one of the guys used to say, I want to get tattoos on my knuckle. Yeah. I want to get love on this one and fear on this one. And he said, because I'm always either in love or fear. You know, I'm always either stepping towards the light or turning my back on it and stepping towards the darkness. It's like that all the time, all day long. Am I going to act in love or am I going to act in fear? Well, we have something here that is simply amazing. These 12 steps. This going to meetings every day and listening to half a dozen people give little snippets of truth, building up a body of knowledge that helps our intuition to work, is the path to love. It's the path out of fear. And, you know, we all walk a tightrope of sanity in this world because it's a crazy world. But if you work this program, that narrow tightrope becomes a broad highway. It is the road to happy destiny. And I hope that you will join us on this road to happy destiny. Thank you.